From the broken ruins of Babylon, this is End of Days Radio. I'm your host, Daniel, broadcasting to you from that shimmering emerald city right here in the heart of the Pacific Northwest. Today's date is Saturday, August 8th in the year of our Lord, 2026. Very glad to be here with you at the midpoint of summer. We're going to have one heck of a show today. Thank you once again for everybody for sticking out with us throughout the long break and still being a fan of the show and still listening. Today we have a rather interesting guest, perfectly in line with our program's theme. His name's Maxim Firik. He is a paranormal researcher, journalist, and author specializing in the intersection of psychology, popular culture, and unexplained phenomena. With advanced degrees in communication and psychology, Firik has authored multiple books on ufology, some people like to say it like that, UFOlogy, ufology, cryptids, and regional folklore. His work has been featured on Mysterious Universe in Australia and in leading paranormal publications worldwide, and I believe he's been on quite a few shows as well, Midnight in the Desert with Heather Wade, our girl Heather, and several others. But let's go ahead and bring him on, and we will get right into the itty-gritty. Hello, Maxim.
Daniel, thanks so much for the invite. I'm so excited to be on your program and talk about the paranormal apocalypse. So thank you so much. And, you know, you're from Seattle. That's my old stomping grounds. I was stationed there at Bremerton when I was in the Navy. So, you know, we took that ferry from Seattle to Bremerton, you know, on a regular basis. So you have a really cool town there, very liberal, and I really love Seattle. So, you know, you're fortunate to be working and playing there in Seattle. So, you know,
thank you. Good for you. Many people are vicious and hard on Seattle nowadays. It's refreshing to hear somebody with something positive to say.
Well, I remember the old fish market and everything else. It was great. You know, no, Seattle's a great town. So, you know, and how close are you to Tacoma with all the fires?
Pretty close. I believe the fires are actually over and a little bit further off, but we're definitely getting a lot of the smoke.
Yeah, so right. Been, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to breathe right now. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, be careful. You know, it's a health hazard, and you know what to do. So,
well, you know, I like it because it really sets that apocalyptic mood.
It does. I know. Well, I'll tell you. You know, I mean, you know, it's no joking matter. You know, at some point, you know, somebody's going to pull the plug. You know, at some point, the sun's going to burn out, and at some point, it all ends. So, we just don't know when it is. And with my book, The Paranormal Apocalypse, I just wanted to take a look at that and just find out, you know, just take a look at that whole fear and what's resonating and what's sort of like a lot of us are thinking about. So, you know, the book was more for me, more like, I don't know, I think it was like therapy for me. It's therapeutic to write it. And Paranormal Apocalypse is probably one of my best books, and you know, just, you know, getting a whole lot of positive reviews and feedback. So that, you know, as an author, that really means a lot to me. Means a lot to us.
Are you originally from the Michigan area?
No, I went to school in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and at Aquinas College. And I'm a Pennsylvania guy. I live in the mountains of Pennsylvania. My wife and I we're relocating full time to Florida, to Ocala on the Gulf Coast. So we'll be down there starting early September. So it's going to be a new venture. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of paranormal groups down there that I've been associating with, and I'm looking forward to, you know, putting some things together, some conferences. I know the Ocala Bigfoot Expo is one of the biggest ones in the country. You know, I met Jeff Meldrum there and just a bunch of other folks, it's really happening. As a matter of fact, Ocala's the fastest growing city in the United States 3 years straight. So, you know, I mean,
right.
I don't know if you like,
it must be doing something right.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if you like, you know, things that busy, but, anyway, that's the way it is. So, but it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of things to do there, you know, a lot of music. So we're good.
Now, growing up, were you raised with any sort of end times beliefs or anything like that?
You know, I was raised, strict Catholic, and I mean, it's, and it doesn't matter if you're Baptist, Catholic, Jewish, whatever, Protestant. I mean, like, we're all raised with this fear and guilt. You know, if you don't go to church, if you don't say your prayers, if you don't do the right thing, you're going to go to hell, or the devil's going to get you, or whatever. I mean, there was some incarnation of that. And I don't, it wasn't just me, it was everybody. So we were raised with that fear. We were raised with all the nursery rhymes and bedtime stories for kids that were, morality plays. But I mean, but think about it, the witch sticking the kids in the oven, and just, I mean, just the horrible stuff. I mean, these were the Grimm brothers. I mean, these were fairy tales to scare the kids. And I can only imagine how many of us, were traumatized by our upbringing. But, but I was raised with the right amount of guilt, from my church, my family, my community. And that's just the way it is. I mean, it wasn't just me. I think it was a lot of people. So that was part of it too. But, I mean, it's part of our DNA, that's in there too, and when you're growing up, I mean, you're just ripe for the messages that your primary caregivers are giving you, your parents, your neighbors, your relatives. So, it's all pretty much the same. But I mean, not that I had a horrible childhood, because I didn't, but I'm just saying that we were raised with a whole lot of guilt and fear. So, end of story.
Yeah, that makes me think about how much of that type of stuff actually goes on. We're always told, do this, do that. Boogeyman's going to get you, or I
Exactly,
guess, yeah. And then there's the whole Krampus thing, where Krampus was
I
kind of used
know.
as a tool to keep
Gosh,
kids in line.
that's like scary. Come on, who, that's like Freddy Krueger, coming into the bedroom. I mean,
Yeah.
who, I don't know. So there's a million and one examples of that. And in my book, I'll tell you what, I wrote Paranormal Apocalypse because of the fear and paranoia. I wrote it because of the political climate. And I'll tell you this, I don't like what's happening in this country. I think that we're too far to the right, too authoritarian. I don't like what's happening. I really resent what's happening. And what's happening, though, with this administration is they're trying to keep us confused and off balance and keep us in chaos and keep us in fear. And this is the way they control us. And that's why I wrote Paranormal Apocalypse, to go and tell people, don't follow the crowd. Be your own person. Do your own critical thinking. Use common sense. Don't follow anybody. You don't need to have a leader, and you don't even need to have a tribe. Follow yourself. Follow your heart. And you know what to do. But I started off the book with H.P. Lovecraft, and I'm a big fan. I'm a student of H.P. Lovecraft. I always have. But he had a quote. It was his most masterful quote. He said, quote, "The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear, but the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. And that's what's driving the train. Fear drives the train. And there's a lot of people that are afraid. They don't have any self-confidence, any self-worth. They don't have a whole lot going for them. And so what they do is they affiliate themselves with either religious leaders or cult leaders, and they get into a trap. And that's what they do. And I have a number of chapters in Paranormal Apocalypse about some of these cult leaders and how they operate. And it's interesting because they all operate with the same way, the same MO, the same modus operandi. So,
Can you give us an example of one of the occult leaders you talk about?
yeah, Jim Jones. Jim Jones is probably the most infamous. It was the American Apocalypse. And Jim Jones was a minister from Indiana, and he had a congregation. There were a lot of poor black people that he affiliated with. He told people that he was black. He said that he was part black and part Cherokee. And he was a very good-looking, handsome guy with the long sideburns, the shades. And he went to Philadelphia, and he met up with a preacher there that was very dynamic and very charismatic. And Jim Jones, Reverend Jones, emulated this minister. And so when he went back to Indiana, he was just working it. I mean, it's almost like a performance. And then he was under fire in Indiana because he had adopted a black son and I think a Korean daughter. And a lot of the people there in his part of Indiana were not very very friendly. They weren't very progressive, and they were very racist. So Dad Jones, that's what he ended up calling himself, left for San Francisco. And eventually he told his people, again, mainly poor black and white people, told him that the end of the world was coming and the safest place was South America. So he had his congregants go with him to South America. They gave him their money, their passports, their social security checks, everything. They gave it to Reverend Jones. And when they went down there to Guyana in South America, it wasn't the paradise that they were promised. It was hard working conditions, a lot of mosquitoes. I mean, horrible planting conditions. And Jim Jones had them brainwashed. He had loudspeakers talking about Father Jones being just like Jesus. And he used the Bible and scripture as well as drugs and punishment to control his congregants. And I know I was in the outback of Wyoming State in December of 1978. And I was out there in the boondocks for like maybe 2 weeks, no radio, TV, newspapers, anything. And when we came out, the first thing we heard about was 900 people who ritualistically killed themselves drinking the cyanide, drinking the Kool-Aid. And what's interesting, though, is everybody, if they didn't drink it, they would inject this into the kids, you know, with the needles and that. They would inject it into the people. They would shoot the people. And Father Jones, he was the one that never drank the Kool-Aid, but he shot himself. So he took the cowardly way out. But the guy was a real pathogen. He was the most miserable person on earth. And there's nothing good you can say about Reverend Jim Jones, who used the Bible and scripture and the words of Jesus Christ to control his congregants. So just a horrible, and I talk about it in the book. He's just like not a straight shooter, you know, just a despicable human being.
Interesting how his type will capitalize on, you know, that pre-existing belief in the Bible and in God and things that you would think would be positive.
Yeah, but it's such an easy thing to do. I mean, you want to go and control people. If you want to seduce them, use the Bible and use scripture. You know, you come across as being righteous. And there was nothing, none of the case. You know, he was a wolf in sheep's clothing. And, you know, and that's what he did. But I mean, Jim Jones did it. Charles Manson did it. David Koresh did it, on and on and on and on. There's so many examples, and I talk about that in the book. I mean, all these cult leaders, and there's been a lot of them. And again, why do people follow cult leaders? You know, what's the real reason? The reason is that they don't have any kind of feelings of self-worth, self-esteem, or self-independence. They have no autonomy, and they don't respect themselves. They have, you know, they disrespect themselves by turning everything over to a cult leader who will then control them. And, you know, it's sad, but it's also totally masochistic. I mean, there's nothing good about it. It's a total degradation of self to do that. You know, I'm miserable that people could be so gullible and so vulnerable, but they are. I mean, they fall for the words of Jesus Christ and they fall for the words of the Bible, which should be good and righteous, but you know, they're many times they're misused by these cult leaders.
Yeah. I think it's, people, you know, there's that, I think it's a Beatles song where they say, look at all the lonely people. Yeah. That's true. There's a lot of lonely people out there that, you know, they join biker gangs and Church of Scientology and all kinds of weird things, little organizations just to fit in somewhere and have some friends.
Yeah. And listen, Daniel, for your listeners out there, they're feeling lonely tonight. I mean, come on, you know, there's plenty of, you know, call a friend, call a buddy, you know, just, you know, call somebody, you know, send them a song, some, you know, whatever, just do something, you know, just get in the groove and, you know, make something happen, make something positive happen, because that's what we can do. We control, we are a response to what happens before us, and we just respond to that. That's how we're defined. And, you know, I'm just saying that with everything that's happening today, you know, be courageous, be strong, you know, keep your head up and be your own person. That's probably the most important thing we could say. Be your own person because you're perfect as you are. You're beautiful. You're created in God's image and likeness. And you're, you know, we have, as human beings, we have more DNA than the animals. I mean, we can think, we have more cognition, and we have more spirituality. We, that's why we rule this planet. I mean, maybe not so well, you know. I mean, we're killing each other off with bombs and guns and, you know, global warming and all that. And don't for a second say that global warming and climate change isn't a reality, because it is. And the reason that anybody's a skeptic is because these agencies, like Exxon and Mobil, they will pay Penn State University, you know, I don't know, $100,000, you know, $2 million to do a study to challenge climate change, but come out with the answer, the conclusion that there's no such thing. So you have all these academic studies that are funded by big oil, by energy companies, that come out the way they want it to come out. So everything is rigged. The whole system is rigged. Global warming is killing us. Just look at, I mean, just look at what's happening with the number of hurricanes and tornadoes and floods and fires. I mean, look what's happening in Washington State. I mean, you're burning, you know, and look what's happening in California. I mean, this is like apocalyptic.
Yeah. And, you know, funny you brought up Washington State, because I was about to say, these people that claim that we're not damaging the environment, all they have to do is look at the salmon habitats and the salmon runs.
Yeah.
That's evidence right in your face. What happened to all the salmon? If we're not doing something awful to our ecosystem, then why can't I go over to the dock and catch a fish?
Yeah. And, you know, I have a really good friend that lives in North Carolina, and I'm glad that she doesn't live near Asheville, because a couple of years ago, I think it was Hurricane Helene that flooded North Carolina, those mountains of North Carolina around Asheville, with floods of biblical proportions. They've never seen that before. It was just horrendous. The rains just came down, and you know, so we're seeing more of that, and there's more evidence of that. And I think we need to be concerned. And I think since my generation, the baby boomers, you know, I mean, we try to bring that out and talk about it, but I think it's going to be up to the millennials and Generation Z to take to the streets, to do what they need to do, to organize and to demand that the government does the right thing for them, for their children, and for their grandchildren. If we don't do this, like, we're in a real mess, and the end's going to come faster than it should. But I don't know. That's just the way it is. These are serious times, and these are times of concern. And certainly with global warming, things have gotten worse. One interesting thing that happened with the paranormal, I'll say, that concerns climate change, in, I think it was January of 2025, a big chunk of iceberg, calved. It was the size of Chicago, something like 9 miles by 11 miles. And there happened to be a ship of oceanographers about a mile away. So they saw this thing calving. So they went over there, and they had submarine drones that they sent down there to see what was underneath that iceberg that had been there for what, like hundreds or thousands or maybe millions of years, I don't know. But they didn't know what they would find there, and they found some jellyfish, and they found creatures that were larger than they had expected. I mean, it was larger than you would find in that part of the world. But also, they couldn't find out what the life source was, because all these things were like underneath, you know, the darkness of that iceberg. And the scientists didn't know the means of that helped them exist. What was that life force? You know, and they thought that maybe this may be a possible new breakthrough in science, that maybe there was something else happening there as far as creating life or keeping life or preserving life that we don't know about, something that was atypical. But those oceanographers happened to be there at the right place at the right time. So what I'm saying is that science may benefit and has benefited from climate change. And here's one example of it. Although, you know, that iceberg broke up and they were tracking it by satellite and everything. But it was pretty dramatic. But I mean, that went by January of 2025. I mean, who knew that? Who talked about that? You know, I mean, I didn't see it. A whole lot of people, you know, discussing that. So I don't know. But I mean, I'm certainly concerned with climate change and global warming. And I talk about that in Paranormal Apocalypse, because that's part of the equation. You know, when you look at how's it going to end. And I do want to talk about that, because when you look at the possibilities of how this world's going to end, I mean, you have to look at things like global warming and climate change. You look at the natural disasters, and I talked about Hurricane Helene in North Carolina. That was 2024. That was in the Appalachia region of North Carolina. We have man-made disasters like Three Mile Island, certainly Deepwater Horizon, Chernobyl, you know, horrible things like that.
Fukushima.
Exactly.
That was a scary one. My God.
Yeah. We talked about the cult leaders. But the thing that scares me are the pandemics. And we have things out there like monkeypox and Ebola, the coronavirus that wiped out a whole lot of people, 2020 and 2021. And now we have an outbreak of measles. We had measles contained. You know, we were good. Everybody was getting their inoculations. And now there's a little bit of a controversy with that. And I'm not saying anything other than back in the day, there was no freedom of choice with that. It was that you would get inoculated so that your kid wouldn't get measles and spread measles to his classmates. So it wasn't about individual freedom, but it was about individual responsibility. And I want people to hear me loud and clear. That's what it's all about. You know, we need to think about our fellow brothers and sisters in our community and what we can do to keep them safe and what's the best thing we can do for the most people. And certainly with this measles, I mean, this is scary because it's out of control, and our government leaders are allowing this to happen. It's not about personal freedom. It's about personal responsibility. And I'll, you know, challenge anybody, you know, with that.
You mentioned the right earlier. Could you get into that a little bit? Is this disturbing you, seeing a rise of what do we call it, white supremacy or capitalism? What bothers you about it?
Everything. It just pisses me off because, you know, I'm a progressive liberal. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I fought for my country. I'm a patriot. I protested. I did everything I could to, you know, help end the Vietnam War. And, you know, with my brothers, I joined the VVAW, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and we protested. And, you know, and a protest is the least likely form of making change. But what it does is it gets the word out. It lets the officials know that you are discontented with what's happening. So that's what we did. But yeah, I am very much disgusted with the religious right that's joined forces with the political right, groups of people that are white supremacists that have no respect for people that of the Islamic persuasion, people that are transgendered or bisexual or homosexual, all that stuff. Listen, this is our country. It's a melting pot. It's a tapestry. You know, when I was in Vietnam, I fought for everybody. And, you know, as a progressive liberal, I respect the rights of everybody, and specifically minorities, because they don't have voice, because, you know, they're being shunned and discarded and everything else. So, no, I hate, I resent, I abhor what's happening in this country with, you know, a majority of the MAGA people being white supremacists and all that. And I'll tell you, and, you know, I mean, if I'm crossing any lines or anything, you know, I don't apologize, because I think as an American, as a patriot, we need to speak out about what's happening. And it's horrible. And I can't wait long enough for this Trump character to be out of office. He's the worst thing that ever happened to our country. He's the worst leader we ever had. He is fleecing us. I mean, I can't say enough. So anyway, I know, Dan, I know this isn't a political show, but the politics was what sort of encouraged me to write Paranormal Apocalypse. You know, I was just so upset that we are being controlled. We are being scared by political groups, by religious groups, by society. And there's too much of that. There's too many people walking around in fear. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I talked about Lovecraft and about the fear of the unknown. His message is associated with ancient fears of biblical prophecy and also fear mongers warning about the apocalypse and impending social collapse. And these are both religious and secular. But another one, Victor Hugo, he was a author and human rights activist. And he said that. He was the one who wrote Hunchback of Notre Dame and La Miserable. But Hugo said this, and this is a great quote. Quote, "The future has many names. For the weak, it means the unattainable. For the fearful, it means the unknown. For the courageous, it means opportunity." And that's exactly how we should take a look at fear. My book is not anti-science, but I believe that the major contributions that have been made certainly with the paranormal have not been made by scientists, by literary prophets, people like H.P. Lovecraft and Jules Verne and Victor Hugo. They've given us the vision and they've given us the prophecy. And that's what I think we need to look at. But again, of all the scientists and theologians out there, nobody can touch H.P. Lovecraft for his warning, his admonition that the strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. And, you know, that's what's happening now.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of those H.P. Lovecraft stories scare me senseless.
Yeah, I know.
You know, probably the most popular one, the Call of Cthulhu.
I know. Yeah. Let me hear you pronounce that again.
Cthulhu.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Am I doing it right?
You know, everybody I talk to has it slightly different, but that's about as close as you can get. Yeah. It's like a guttural gothic thing. You know, I mean, you got to like, you know, twist your lips and everything, but he did it purposely. You know, he made it, you know, Lovecraft was ingenious, but you read his books and they're boring. He bores you to death. And then at the end, the protagonist goes mad or starts taking drugs, you know, opium or laudanum or whatever. And, only because Lovecraft said that we are unable to comprehend. The biggest fear is that we can't comprehend this awesome, you know, this mystery, this awesome evil that's out there. And so that's what he did, not only for the paranormal, but he did that for the haunted house genre he talked about, you know, that the scariest thing is that, you know, we'll never understand. And think about that. I mean, you know, as cognitive human beings, you know, who, you know, I mean, we pride ourselves on our intellectualism and all that. I mean, but if you can't understand a certain thing, you know, that's kind of frightening. And that's what Lovecraft gave us. I mean, he filled us with fear. I mean, he bored us to death and then he scared us. So that was his, you know, his 1-2 punch.
He definitely, I think he was tapping into something ancient, not only with the names of these deities. They have almost, they sound like an ancient language, like Akkadian or something like that. And,
and then at
the same time, he kind of had a way of setting the mood. I know he was partially inspired by Edgar Allan Poe.
Right, yeah.
You read enough Poe, you want to go hang yourself or something. It's so gloomy.
Yeah, you can't believe it.
Well,
Poe was a despondent alcoholic. You know, he tried to kill himself with laudanum. I think he married his 14-year-old cousin, something like that. I mean,
wish they did back then.
Yeah, all of his women were like pale and thin and on death's door, and you know, God, I mean, all kinds of stuff. I mean, that nobody was right. You know, they were all weird chicks, but that's what Poe wrote about. And and he died. Let me see. I'm trying to think. I think, I don't know,
It was a bad death. It was something really just like he slumped over or something like that.
They were trying to get these drunks to go and vote. There was these political people. That's what it was. And I think I forget what happened. I forget his backstory. But anyway, it was tragic. I mean, you know, he's one of the great American writers. He gave us the first mystery, the first murder mystery. And my favorite and my latest book is The Scream of the Haunted House. And I would love to get back on your show and talk about that. That just came out just a short time ago. But I talk about Edgar Allan Poe, and his contribution was Fall of the House of Usher. And just like an ingenious story about the haunting, the house itself is embedded with this evil, you know, that, you know, not just Roderick Usher and Madeline, his sister, but the whole house just reeks of evil. And Edgar Allan Poe did a similar thing as Henry James with Turn of the Screw, and Elizabeth Jackson with The Haunting of Hill House. Those are excellent, excellent examples of books about haunted houses, and we owe a lot to these folks. So,
Do you take some personal inspiration from Lovecraft and Poe?
Yeah, I do. I've always been a fan of Edgar Allan Poe, but Lovecraft in particular, just because, I mean, like, I just love the multi-layered thing, what he does, and
mythos.
The first one he did was Dagon, D-A-G-O-N, and this is pretty much typical of Lovecraft, but the guy is, ends up on an island, and here there's this statue, and they're worshiping the statue, and here it's like a squiggly, almost, Daniel, almost like your logo for End of Days, but it's like a octopus squid thing, a creature that's paying homage to this monolith, this idol, and the man goes insane. And so he makes it back stateside, but he's insane because he can't tolerate, he can't understand, he can't perceive, he can't comprehend what was incomprehensible. And that was this thing. So many of the stories end like that. The people go mad because they don't understand. And so that's a scary thought, you know? We're here to put two and two together and to try to figure things out. But when you can't, when he tells you that you'll never know, you know, you're never going to be able to figure it out. That's pretty frightening in itself. But that was Lovecraft's thing. That's what he did, and he did it well.
Yeah, you know, after doing the show for over a decade and being interested in researching a lot of these fringe topics, I'd have to say that's a very real possibility. You know, going completely insane.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I talked about human cognition and, you know, having more DNA and everything, but I think that one thing we in the paranormal, we really need to take a look at our ability, Lovecraft talked about our inability to understand, but talk about our abilities, our psychic abilities. And I think that every one of us has inside psychic abilities, whether it's remote viewing or astral projection, which I am highly, you know, personally invested in.
Really?
But with remote viewing, I don't, have you seen Disclosure Day?
I have not, but yeah. You know, the topic of remote viewing is that's a hot topic, you know, going back to the coast to coast days with Ed Dames and
and with in Disclosure Day, and I don't think I'm giving anything away, but there's a scene where the government official, this guy, ominous looking dude with a beard, is doing this remote viewing, and he reaches this young girl and he's sucking out the data from her, and it's real, like this push and pull, this give and take. It's really ominous, but it's the best portrayal I've ever seen of remote viewing. And you know, that's how Jacques Vallée was a great accomplished remote viewer. So it's something that I think that we can do, we can teach ourselves to do. But the thing that is of interest is that I believe we have these innate abilities that can manifest if we work at it. And again, it's difficult because you can't really have a 9-to-5. You can't be bombarded with the white noise and the disruption, but you have to go and spend time in prayer and meditation and in silence to go and invoke, you know, whatever gifts you have. And I think we all have those, but, you know, I think that there's work to be done to reach that point.
Yeah, I can say I've had a handful of those experiences. And I usually just don't bring them up. You know, people think you're either a BS artist or you're completely mad. But, you know, that's something that I've experienced early in my life and mm-hmm. even somewhat recently. So I'm there with you 100%. I think, you know, in the occult world, they call it scrying, when you view something from a distance. So it's nothing new to humanity. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly something I think that we probably are programmed to not believe in.
By society, or maybe by organized religion. And I don't know if you've come across this, but there's so many ministers now, I mean, religious guys, that are saying that aliens are demonic. And I'm wondering, like, I mean, how did they get into our world? How did they crawl into the paranormal realm? You know, I mean, why don't they stay on their side? You know, so again, it's just like a lot of organized religion are blinded by seeing the world in just shades of black and white, good and evil, without taking a look at all the shades of gray and all of the other nuances there. And it's totally wrong. It's the wrong way to look at things. I have plenty of friends that are pagans, that are Wiccans, that are Druids. And these were the ancient religions before Christianity came around. And these were people that worshiped and loved their higher power, their God, in their own way. They weren't of the devil. They weren't satanic. They loved nature, and they did it their way. And then when Christianity came along, you know, they saddled those people with the concept of being, you know, in league with the devil, which is not true, and it's just so unfair. And again, I know I have personal friends that are Wiccan and pagan, and you know, and they're wonderful people. They have good hearts, and they're altruistic, and I think they need to be defended. So that's why I say that.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. You know, I myself, I'm a Christian, but I've dipped my beak in paganism and things like Wicca and things like that. Yeah. And I think it really comes down to, are you a good person or not? You could be a Christian and be completely filthy. We're not supposed to judge one another. That's not our place in the grand scheme of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So, anyway, that's like to bash organized religion, but man, it's hard not to. I mean, they take our money and they corrupt us and everything else. I mean, I'm not.
Yeah. I mean, if you really want to get into it, like, all you have to do to point out religion controlling people are two things: the Vatican and Israel. You know, the dual citizenship and the way the Vatican has controlled all these countries and monarchies throughout the ages. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's proof. You know, control through religion.
I consider myself a Catholic Buddhist, and I love Catholicism. I love Saint Michael the Archangel, who is the patron saint for Jews, Catholics, and Islam, and St. Teresa of Avila, the 17th century Spanish mystic, who said that through prayer and meditation, we can reach states of ecstasy, rapture, and what she called flight of the soul, which is an out-of-body experience. And she was just such a wonderful... I mean, I'm in love with St. Teresa of Avila, but there's documented evidence that she actually levitated, and the nuns had to hold her down on the bed. She was embarrassed by that. And another one that's my patron saint is Padre Pio. And, you know, this may sound a little bit weird, but there's my Padre Pio holy water that I got at. But anyway, Padre Pio, he had the stigmata, and he bled the wounds of Christ, and people would go. And this is interesting. So he was a man of faith, but he bled. He suffered for his beliefs. He had a thing called bilocation. Documented cases where they saw Padre Pio at place A, you know, giving us a lecture to all of his brothers and the priests, and then they saw him again the same time 100 miles away someplace else by location. Two places at the same time. Yeah, Padre Pio. So, but
that is interesting.
But so Padre Pio's had a church in Italy, and all these people are coming to his church to see the stigmata, to watch him bleed, and to have him say a prayer and everything. And the Vatican didn't know what to do with this because they thought Padre Pio was delusional, and he was able to convince thousands of people of his delusions. So he was under the gun. He suffered with the stigmata. He suffered from skeptics. He suffered from the naysayers from the Vatican that didn't believe him, that he was a con artist. So at the end of the day, he wasn't a con artist. He was a miracle worker. You know, and again, with all these saints, it's not that they had these abilities, superhuman abilities, but it's, again, all things through God. God works through those to manifest the miracles. And the way that works is if you're chosen, if you're pious and have the faith, and if you have a pretty good track record, then just maybe God, you know, the higher power, the source, will go and, you know, bless you with the ability to perform miracles. That's how it works. So
yeah, I'm
never going to be called, but you know,
I think what it is you know, you held up that holy water a moment ago, and like a saint is somebody, I guess you could say, is closer to God, and because of that, they vibrate in a more pure frequency, and then when they touch water, they transfer that higher frequency actually into the water, because we know water can, it has memory.
And then
we can draw upon that water and maybe use it in something like an exorcism to counter the low vibration of, you know, whatever is going on there, be it a demon or some kind of weird alien or whatever these entities are. Like, you know, I noticed you have a painting of, it's a nice painting of some grays back there. I got a little gray alien behind me too. But do you have any theories on what the grays are or any opinions on that at all?
I don't know. You know, of all of the research I've done, of all the books I've done, like with cryptids and Bigfoot, flying saucers, I like to call them flying saucers and UFOs. I mean, I hate that Pentagon term of UAPs, but you know, whatever, but that's just my bias. But of all the things that I research and write about, it's demonology that really just pushes my buttons and gets me excited. I think this is the truth and this is the reality. There's ghosts and spirits and demons out there. You know, I don't know about flying saucers and Bigfoot creatures. I think they exist on another level, on a maybe a interdimensional level. You know, and I believe that they are real, but it's very difficult to go and come up with any kind of proof. I think there's more tangible evidence for life, for an afterlife, and most. Let me rephrase it. I think all mythologies and organized religion believe in an afterlife, whether they admit it or not. So they all try to connect with the departed, whether it's through an exorcism or through any kind of a rite to recognize them. You know, the Day of the Dead, where a lot of the Mexicans and South Americans will celebrate that person's life. And it's not a funeral. It's not a sad time, but it's a celebration of what they represented. You know, they will give them gifts. They would give them, you know, their bottles of liquor and their whatever they were into. So, you know, we're all doing that. We're not leaving the departed go. We're trying to stay with them and be with them. But I don't know about, you know, the grays. All I know is that I'm hearing a lot of talk about, you know, again, from mainly from religious leaders, evangelicals, the religious right, that the grays and the aliens are demonic. And I don't believe that at all. I just think that with some of these guys, if you're not firm into Jesus Christ, Lord and Savior, if you don't, you know, sign on to that, then somehow you're demonic or you're wrong. And that's not true. So.
Yeah, the universe is very mysterious, and all these different cultures out there, they have unique beliefs. A lot of them, they will kind of cross over and align with each other, but some are just outrageously different.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of creatures in these individual cultures that that we might find in the future are actually real. You know, like you mentioned Sasquatch earlier, just about every native tribe has a name for Sasquatch. And, yeah. you know, some of this latest research coming out about Bigfoot, they're saying he's psychic. He has his own language. Yeah. He'll trade things with people occasionally. Wild stuff.
I talk to these guys. I do a lot of podcasts up in Canada and British Columbia. And there's a lot of these guys that they're friends with Sasquatch. They claim that Sasquatch is the teacher and they're the student. They claim that the Sasquatch gives them gifts. For example, the one guy, his house was locked up. And his bedroom was locked up, but there on his bedroom desk was this gift, and I forget what it was. I know feathers or something that Sasquatch gave him. They claim that Sasquatch communicates telepathically. That Sasquatch also has a thing called rapid locomotion, where you see them rapid transport, where you see them in front of you, then you see them behind you. That Bigfoot. Emanates, doesn't reflect light, but emanates light. Just a whole lot of things. So there's this whole new world out there of people describing what Bigfoot represents. One thing that I find of interest, I may be able to be on a podcast with Whitney Strieber, who did a lot of this, alien abduction stuff. So we're putting this together for the next couple of months, which I'm really excited to be on the same stage with him. But in my book, The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, in 1924, Albert Osman, a Swedish-Canadian trapper, was upset because something was messing with his campsite, taking things, you know, being disruptive and everything. So Albert Osman decided to play a trick, and he hid himself in a sleeping bag with a rifle. And he was going to wait until this culprit, you know, showed up again. He was going to shoot him. And what happened was he fell asleep and something hoisted him up and just carried him for miles and miles. And they dumped him in this valley. Here it was a Sasquatch family. I mean, ostensibly a mother, father, daughter, and son. And the daughter, the Bigfoot daughter, was watching Osman feeding him sweetgrass. And they were very curious. They were gentle. They were kind. But Osman got the idea and said that they were going to use him to procreate. They were going to use him for sexual purposes. So Osman freaked out, as I think I would too, you know. And he had some chewing tobacco in his sleeping bag. So what he did was he enticed the father Bigfoot, the papa bear, to take some of this chewing tobacco. And the Sasquatch got sick. So Osman took off. And here's the interesting thing. This is 1924. He took off and didn't say anything. He wasn't looking for publicity. But there were a whole lot of articles back then in British Columbia about seeing these creatures, these cryptids, you know, these shaggy creatures that they were calling Sasquatch. And Osman said, you know what, this might be a good time for me to go and relate my story. So what he did was he contacted John Green. John Green was one of the original Four Horsemen of Sasquatchery. And John Green was a journalist from British Columbia. And he took the story, and he believed that Albert Osman was telling the truth, that he actually was, captured, abducted by these Bigfoot. Now, what's interesting is that this happened back in a time when there was no internet, there was no computers or microfiche or anything else. Albert Osman didn't have the ability to go and research how Bigfoot operates and how Bigfoot groups operate. What he told was the stuff that he had experienced. But they were gentle. It was one of the few examples of describing a group of Bigfoot. There was no smell. Typically, we have the smell of rotten eggs, of wet dog, of fecal matter, sulfur connected with Bigfoot that may, and let me interject here, may be Bigfoot coming in through a portal. That smell, that stench may represent like a potato bin kind of smell from that dimension. And when the portal opens,
I'm pretty sure I caught whiffs of that up here in Washington, that you know, it might be a portal smell or something like that.
Yeah.
It smells similar to like a skunk, but a little bit different. And I imagine that's why he's called a skunk ape by some cultures. But, you know, for all I know, it was a dead raccoon or an actual skunk. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating how you always hear about the smell in every Bigfoot encounter.
Oh, yeah, always. With the exception of Albert Osman, there was no smell there. So that was kind of interesting. So that was the one thing that he didn't talk about. But maybe that smell is either the remnants from the portal, or maybe it is a defense mechanism, just, you know, that like skunks use, you know, just to keep people away. So this was 1924. So Albert Osman was abducted. Now, fast forward to 1962, 1963, Betty and Barney Hill get abducted. And all of a sudden, you know, with Bigfoot, it was just one and done. But with ufology, this became a cottage industry. It became a huge thing with people like Whitney Strieber, people like John Mack from Harvard, that started to study this and find out there's a whole lot of people that can relate to being abducted by these grays, by these aliens, and probed and everything else. So whatever that is, whatever that represents, there seems to be a lot of people that have experienced this trauma, and they're coming forward. What's interesting is when John Mack from Harvard was researching this, he had a lot of pushback from the academic community. And that always seems to be the problem, you know, whether you're a J. Allen Hynek or a John Mack,
or a Graham Hancock.
Graham Hancock. So many of these folks have been able to speak out, you know, Jeff Meldrum. Jeff Meldrum, when I talked to him, he said that he was he would be the last person to be invited to the high table, the scientific high table, because a lot of those scientists, you know, looked down on people like him who dabbled in cryptozoology or in the paranormal. And Jeff, you know, you can't refute the contributions that Jeff Meldrum made to the world of cryptozoology and parapsychology, certainly with his knowledge of locomotion and a stride and his collection of the foot casts and everything. I mean, he was the man. And I mean, we lost him in, I think it was December of 2025, but it was just such a loss. There's nobody else out there. I mean, Lauren Coleman, there's nobody else out there that was of his stature.
But I know there was one group that found hairs, and they actually tested the hairs, and it turned out to be unknown hominid. So a lot of people think there's no physical evidence for Bigfoot, but they're overlooking that particular case where they found a bunch of footprints and a bunch of his fur and stuff like that. I'm pretty sure it was kind of orange, like orangutan fur.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, in an area where there's obviously no orangutans.
Yeah. Well, Gigantopithecus was the largest ape. It looked like an orangutan, and supposedly that came over across the Bering Strait from Asia to the Pacific Northwest and up in northern Canada. And so that's the theory. One theory is that Bigfoot actually was the remnants of Giganto, that may not be true, because what happened was talk about climate change. Everything changed, and all of the succulent fruit that was hanging low went high up in the tree. Giganta was too big to climb the tree to get those nutrients, so it ended up eating acorns and leaves and twigs and everything else, and eventually died off. Giganta died off because of its size. It couldn't maintain that size. And again, they attribute that to global warming, which happens on not just man-made, but that could be cyclical as well.
Used to have way back in the olden days, it was kind of like one of those carnival exhibits, carny type of things. And the display exhibit was called the Wild Men of Borneo.
Yeah.
Yeah, you heard about that. And guys that are almost like they're not fully evolved or something like that. I wonder if that could be related to Bigfoot somehow.
In my book, The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot is a metaphor for who or what Bigfoot could be. We really don't know, but we have some good theories. You know, Gigantopithecus was one. Neanderthal is another one. Australopithecus. There's just a whole lot of them, and we just don't know. But Jeff Meldrum thought that maybe Giganto was a possibility. So we don't know. But anyway, Lost Tribes of Bigfoot took a look at that metaphorically to look at all these things. So with that connection between Albert Ostman's abduction and then Betty Hill and Barney Hill, there was another parallel with the 1967 Patterson-Gimlin film, which we think is still today is the Holy Grail. That's the proof we've been looking to prove that Bigfoot does exist, Patty. And the other one, the equivalent that in ufology would be the 2002 Tic Tac video that the Navy pilots on the Nimitz took. And this is the thing that hung up there. It zigged back and forth, zigzagged back and forth, and then it went under the water. And the Pentagon that had changed UFO to UAP, unidentified area phenomenon, then changed that to UAP, unidentified anomalous phenomenon, because it went underwater. It wasn't just airborne. So, but we have not been able to refute that. I mean, that's just like an amazing, amazing video that we have. And again, there's something there. Again, what is it? The Navy pilots weren't able to track it, to keep up with it. It zigzagged. The turns they made were just too powerful for a human being to withstand that. So we knew that it was whatever was guiding it, wasn't human. And again, we don't know. 3% of these things we see are anomalous. They're either ours, theirs, or they're from out there. So we don't know. So that's probably the beauty of the paranormal, that we have, that we try to figure it out. We try to figure out what's around the corner, much like the apocalypse, much like my book, Paranormal Apocalypse.
That was kind of my starting point getting into this stuff was when I was 18 years old. I had a few experiences before this, but the one that made me a little bit, I guess, obsessed with, fringe topics and things that I cover on my show, I saw that exact thing, a craft, and it was shooting in directions that it should not have been able to.
Yeah,
turning on a dime, like anybody would get killed if there's a human inside a ship.
Exactly.
Like that.
Yeah.
Very, very.
And we
stuff.
Know this because they have these centrifuges, like at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and they have these pilots go in there to see how much G-force they can withstand.
Yeah.
They can only withstand so much, and then we black out. So with those UAPs. From 2004, I mean, it was just wicked wild. It was like Mr. Toad's wild ride. bleeding and everything else. And
what kind of helped me was I read about the Tesla UFO blueprints.
Yeah.
And that kind of helped me understand a little bit. I guess what was going on is, or what possibly is going on, is they're building some kind of machine that can create a field where there's no friction.
Okay.
And if there's no friction, that's what would allow a craft to change directions without disintegrating.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about as much as I can get into it, obviously.
It's
stuff that's over my head.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about the paranormal is, we keep on changing. We try to use the scientific method to come up with the best hypotheses. And what we need to do is we need to go and conjure up, offer up hypotheses for us to take a look at and see what works and what doesn't. And probably the best example of that would be extraterrestrial travel. We used to talk about Space Brother traveling trillions of light years, from their planet to ours. And that sounded good and everything, but in retrospect, it would just take too much time, too much effort, too much energy, very, very difficult or impossible to pull off. So it was Einstein and Rosen that talked about the bridge theory or the wormhole theory that said something like this, that if you could take the space-time continuum and fold it in half and punch a hole through it, you could get through that like in a microsecond. From one dimension to another, from one portal to another, make more sense than saying that that you could go from one planet to the other. So the interdimensional connection, you know, that Jacques Vallée and John Keel have signed on to, that seems to be a lot more applicable. It makes more sense. And I've signed on to that. I mean, I believe that, as I said earlier, that flying saucers, UFOs, and Bigfoot, especially, you know, cryptids, especially Bigfoot, zigzag, they shapeshift through these portals. And that's their mechanism. And that's why you see them and then you don't. And again, I don't know about the aliens. I mean, everybody's asking me about, you know, why are they here and what do they do? And what about the grays? I don't know. I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. I mean, you know, all I know is that there's a lot of people calling these aliens evil. And, you know, that got to be rectified. So I don't know.
Well, Maxim, let me ask a little bit of a challenging question to you. So in a lot of these abductions, people are paralyzed.
Yeah.
They're taken against their will.
Right.
And sexual and often painful experiments are performed on them. Now, doesn't that to you sound like it could be evil?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It also sounds like it could be the evil sexual abuse. It could be sexual trauma from childhood. It could be that, you know, when we're traumatized and when we're kids, what we do is with that trauma, we lock it away, we repress it, we push it away, we put it into maybe into a lockbox, and it's there. It happened to us, but we could go and control it. You don't repress it because that it'll come out. It'll come out with drugs and alcohol, sex and everything else. But you could put it in that little safe place, that lockbox, realizing that it's part of you, but you didn't cause it. It wasn't your fault. You know, it's not going to happen again, and you're safe now. So that's the evil of sexual abuse. And I think that with the abductions, I think there's some of that plays a part in it. I think there may be residue of sexual abuse, sexual trauma that is manifested through this thing. Again, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I mean, this is, you know, what's been theorized before, but I just think that there may be something to it other than, you know, extraterrestrial craft and all that. That may be a way to conjure it, but again, I don't know. But there's when.
And to be fair, I have also heard stories of them curing people's diseases.
Okay. Okay.
And stopping nuclear weapons too.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean,
in our field, in our realm, you know, we talk to a whole lot of people and we get a whole lot of theories. So, you know, I don't know what's true, but certainly you have to say this, with the alien abductions, it took off and a lot of people stood up and said, yes, this happened to me as well. So there's some commonality there, whatever that is. Whatever that commonality is, the common denominator, you know, whether it's sexual abuse or something else, I don't know. But, you know, there's something there that really needs to be investigated. And I know that John Mack did some good work. I really, you know, I've been meaning to go and read up on some of his stuff and some of his theories. But, you know, we'll see. But like I said, Whitney Strieber was involved in that. And I was just contacted by a podcaster a couple of days ago about the possibility of being on a show with them, which would be astounding, you know, so I would love to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. His story is still so mysterious. And actually, you know, if you actually listen to him tell it, it's probably a little bit different than people would recall or think.
Yeah. And, well, it was communion, right? Was it communion?
Yeah, yeah. And I believe he's also had a radio show or a podcast for a number of years.
Okay. I should reach out to him, yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. He's a pretty good host.
Yeah.
What about you, Maxim? Do you have a podcast? Are you planning to do one?
No, I don't have a podcast. I mean, a lot of people are asking me about that, but I don't. I mean, it's labor intensive, it's time intensive. You know, what I do is I write books. I research, write, and promote. That's what I do. And you know, I'm going through a pretty just like a wild time of a creative time. I've been, you know, really prolific, and everything's just, you know, taken off pretty good. And I don't know if I could, I can, hang on, I could probably put up a, let me do this, an image for your viewers to see. Unknown 222, hang on, it's image. Hang on 1 second. See if you could read. Okay, good. Here, write this. And see if you could see this, Daniel.
Oh, absolutely. Let's see. Just add to the stage.
Okay, there it is.
Here.
Okay, yeah, good.
There
okay.
We go.
Okay, so paranormal monkey shines, the hoaxers of high strangeness. So what I do is I'm calling out the hoaxers. This is the next book, and I'm working on this. Hope to have it done in maybe another 2 or 3 months. But Roswell, Loch Ness, we know that. The Roswell autopsy was all bogus. I mean, come on, that's, you know, it was just ridiculous. The KGB had an equivalent one. The Loch Ness, there was a Wilson who took a picture of a toy sea serpent. You know, it was floating there. They took that picture, said it was a Loch Ness monster. The Dulce shootout underneath Nevada, you know, with the grays, the, what, 12-foot grays. And then Piltdown, one of the biggest hoaxes ever, where Charles Dawson claimed that he discovered this Piltdown man. And what happened was he used an old skull, you know, it was thousands of years old. He used a jaw of an orangutan. He used iron oxide to make everything look older. And he took the orangutan's jaw and filed down the teeth to make him look more human. So it was just a con job. And then George Adamski, who's the biggest con artist of all, but he was a paradox because he would show pictures of chicken crates. He would show pictures and hang on 1 second. Do I have, I'm glad we have this technology. Let me just show you this real fast. Is that Adamski? Yeah. Okay, right here. Yeah. Now take a look at this. So this is Adamski. Let me see if I could bring this up, because this is worthy of looking at.
All right.
Okay, this image file, and that would be, okay, Adamski. So this is Adamski. See if you could bring him up. There he is.
There he is.
He was a Polish-American. He had, I think, a third or fourth grade education. He spoke broken English, but he was charismatic. I mean, the women loved him, and everybody did his bidding. But here's the thing. Let me show you this one. This is like crazy. This is what? Okay, right here. Image. And that was Adamski UFO. And look at this. Bring this up for your audience, please. Okay. Now, you know what that is? He said it was a flying saucer. That's a chicken incubator crate. They would put the eggs in there or something to keep the things warm. That's what, and people bought that. I mean, he did
all kinds
of, like
the heaters in the middle.
I mean, look at that. I mean, people bought into that. You know, that was like wicked crazy, you know, Adamski.
Yeah.
But what he did do, he was an ambassador of the new age. And this was right after we dropped the bombs in 45 on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And what Adamski was doing was saying that the Space Brothers, he claimed that he was talking to these people from Venus. He claimed that the Space Brothers were here to save us. They were warning us about self-destruction. And and in that respect, Adamski really did something for the good of the order. He gave us some hope that the Space Brothers would come here and help us to save ourselves. So that's what he did. So he was a paradox, but the FBI kept a file on him, wanted to know what was going on with him. And but anyway, all of this will be in that Monkey Shines, that Monkey Shines book. And I'm looking for it. So that'll be out before too long. So, but anyway, so I'll have that along with Paranormal Apocalypse, you know, in my library.
All right. So at what point did you decide to sit down and become a writer?
Well, I really didn't. I was always a writer. I was writing since I was 5 years old. I used to draw a lot. I was a pretty good artist at the time, but they say that, when you could get back on a bicycle, and if you haven't ridden a bike in a while, you could get back on it and still ride. And I can't draw like I used to. I used to be really good. I used to love doing that, but I just lost that talent, that ability, that aptitude, that even that interest, So, but no, I used to draw, and then I wrote a lot. I used to draw comic books, and I used to write crazy stuff. And I was really into the supernatural, horror. I mean, I love horror movies, love to get scared, read a lot of books about science fiction. And when I went to school, for some reason in the grade school, they had science fiction books about going to other planets and seeing these creatures, insect-like creatures. And but I couldn't get enough of that, and I just enjoyed that. And, I had a career as a psychologist. I worked in addictions and recovery, and then I was a rock journalist, and that was really my passion. I mean, I love rock and roll. I love music. But about 11 years ago, I wrote a book called The Shepton Myth, Miracle, and Music, and that sort of took off, and that's when the paranormal hit me over the head. I didn't go looking for the paranormal, but it stalked me, it found me, and it slammed me with the 2x4, and so here I am. But I can't say enough about being in the realm of the paranormal. I'll say off the bat, I'm a skeptic, but I view this as a skeptic. I'm looking for proof. I look at it through the lens of an academic, and I think if that does anything for the good of the order, it's maybe, getting us a little bit closer to the scientific. So.
Yeah, well, there's nothing wrong with being a skeptic. It certainly keeps you from becoming one of these people that join a cult and end up drinking purple
yeah.
Kool-Aid.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that. No, I'm not joining any cult. Yeah, so.
Yeah, I mean a little bit. I mean, I'm a little bit too open-minded sometimes. I'll believe people's BS because, I suppose because I've had a few experiences, it makes me more likely to believe others when they tell me. But you also have to remember there's deceivers out there, there's liars, there's people that want attention, there's people that will go as far as to sew a fish to a fetus and call it a mermaid. That's how far people will go.
Danny, I want to see if I could go and access a short clip for your listeners. Hang on, MP4, hang on 1 second, see if this will play, because it's kind of cool. And this is one thing we're using. Nope. Hang on 1 second. The video. Okay, here. This is it. Good. Okay, here we go. See if you could get that. I just uploaded that.
Here we go. Add to stage.
Good. Good, okay. Give a listen.
The scream of the haunted house is heard. In the shadows, hear the call. Something's waiting in the hall. W. Furick. The Ghost Hunter's Bible. Available from Hangar One Publishing. Coming soon.
Heck of a promotion.
I know. Is that wild or what? That was.
Yeah, I love that. That's a good idea. Boy, this is. A departure from Apocalypse. It looks terrifying.
The book's been out a short time, and I'm really excited. This is probably going to be one of a really big seller. I interviewed a ton of people to get their 2 cents into the book, but it's really a good book. Exploring the demonic and the afterlife. So that was Doug Hychek from Hangar One. He's a a promoter, a podcaster, and a musician. And he put that together. And I mean, how many authors have a song written about their books, you know? So, you know, I'm pretty blessed to have that. But yeah, that's been making the rounds, and that's pretty effective, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in the social media age where mm-hmm. you could post things all across the board and I get retweets and things like that. I think that's definitely a smart idea to market. We are getting kind of low on time here. And know one of the topics you cover is AI. Yeah. Before we run out of time, did you want to get into AI a little bit?
Yeah, just a little bit. I mean, of all the things that we're dealing with, that we're afraid of how the world's going to end, I think that AI is one thing we have to take a look at. I have a chapter called When Robots Attack. And I take a look at things like Y2K. I take a look at the possibility of computers becoming smarter than us. And remember in HAL, in 2001, A Space Odyssey, how the computer would not unlock the door. And it was really just the most ominous, scary thing. And that sort of like... gave us the message, the fear, the apprehension that something like this was possible. But when you take a look at AI, that does have a lot of benefit in medicine and in just a whole lot of things. You know, certainly you get on the computer and you try to do some research, and there's always an AI thing where it gives you, it's like Wikipedia, it gives you the whole thing there. So some of that stuff's beneficial as far as doing research and everything. But the problematic part is that with some authors that I know, they use AI to write their works, and rather than doing it themselves. And I abhor that. I hate that. That's just like the worst thing. And, you know, and as an author who prides himself in, you know, being, you know, I hope well-written, you know, I just dislike AI, and but it's here. It's not going away. It's getting larger and larger and larger. It's getting bigger. It's getting better, and it's getting to the point where, you know, I don't know. I mean, we're gonna need some rules and regulations about AI, because you know. So I don't know.
It's taken over my life. I can't imagine not using it now. I mean, between figuring out problems on the computer to just knowing where to get some crayfish or designing artwork and things like that. I'm dependent on it. I hate to say it. I'm literally dependent on it.
Yeah. Well, we're dependent on our computers. And so it's just another, you know, generation. It's another progression of the computer, you know, the AI, I think. And it's all part and parcel of that. But, you know, so, but it's, you know, there were people back in the, 1700s, 1800s that would talk about the cars, the automobiles, you know, I mean, not being a good thing, you know, that being afraid of the technology, you know, thinking that maybe technology would take away from too much. And, you know, we'll have this discussion, you know, as we've had discussions before about, you know, computers and television. You know, is television brainwashing the minds of the children, you know, watching all that stuff? I mean, that conversation probably went on, you know, the last 50 years. So, you know, so I don't, I think we need to be maybe respectful of AI and what AI can do and what AI should not be allowed to do.
Yeah, you know, a buddy of mine, he made a good point to me. This was years ago, but I was kind of going off on him and saying, you know, all this stuff's evil, the smartphones and this and that. And he said, well, you can look at it the other way. And let's say evil is control this stuff. What happens if we overthrow them? We'll have all this amazing technology and stuff at our fingertips, and it'd be quite beautiful, really.
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's going to happen. Listen, before we break, I just want to say this to your audience. I have a website. It's www.maximfurek.com. And you could check out all my books there. You know, if you want to score an autographed copy of my book, just contact me, you know, and I could hook you up with that. And I would say this, if anybody purchases any of my books, like Paranormal Apocalypse or Scream of the Haunted House, please be so kind as to leave a review on Amazon. I mean, we live and breathe for that. We need that, Daniel, just like you need people to go and like your podcast and maybe help monetize it. So it's important that we get those reviews because it drives the, it drives the AI algorithm, you know, and we're dealing with that too.
Definitely. Yes. Please, everybody check out, the latest one is it Scream? Scream,
yeah,
or?
Yeah. No, just Scream, the Scream of the Haunted House. And, in the back, this was from Kristen Amanda, host of the Paranormal Girl podcast. Quote, every paranormal investigator needs this on their shelf. The Scream of the Haunted House is the ghost hunter's Bible.
Ooh, so that
was her words. And then one other thing, let me read the first paragraph. I'll read two. Paranormal author Maxim W. Furyk's groundbreaking book exposes the haunted house as a prison of despair, where earthbound spirits cry for tranquility and tears are shed not from the eyes but from the soul. Despite belief that demonic infestation is rare, the author probes the most terrifying of possibilities. Are ghost hunters disturbing things that should be left alone? Are they conceivable targets of demonic wrath? And has dark tourism, and I explore dark tourism throughout my book, has dark tourism knowingly opened the profane cash registers of hell? So that's the book. And so maybe down the line we could talk about the Ghost Hunter's Bible.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's commit ourselves now. And, you know, Maxim, one thing I've been thinking about since we started the program is the room you're in. That's like the perfect sort of murder mystery writer sort of room. It gives off those vibes. Like I can see myself just hanging out in there all day.
Yeah. I got the coolest office. This is in Pennsylvania. I live in northeastern Pennsylvania, in the mountains of northeastern Pennsylvania. But in the background, I have Kurt Cobain and Cowboy Junkies and a whole bunch of stuff. But I do most of my writing up here. This is the best spot ever. But, you know, we sold this place. We're leaving. So we're going to be in Florida full time. So hopefully I have the same kind of work ethic and creativity that I do up here. But, you know, I'm sure that I will.
So, well, I've heard great things about Florida, mainly that it's nice and warm.
It is, yeah. Nice, hot and humid, yeah. More than warm, you know.
One more for you.
80 and 90 degrees.
Exactly. I got one more question for you, just because I know my audience is probably dying to know this. What do you think of people that are prepping right now, that are thinking end times is on its way, collecting canned foods and raising chickens and things like that? Are they out of their minds, or are they doing something respectable?
No, it's therapeutic. I mean, get ready. I mean, you know, you could have your bomb shelter and you could have your cans of soup and pork and beans and all that and be ready for the day. That's fine. You know, that's therapeutic. You're taking responsibility for your future. But I think the more important thing is to have the proper mindset. You know, be strong, be confident, be courageous. Be your own person. Don't follow leaders. Don't follow groups. You get involved in cults or groups, you have what's called groupthink. You start thinking like them, you know, to conform, to be part of the group, part of the tribe. You start thinking like them. And that denies and disrespects your autonomy. And that's who you are. You have the right to be your own self, your autonomous self, without any kind of interference from external factors. So that's the most important thing. You know, I could tell your audience, believe in yourself, love yourself, support yourself, nurture that inner child. You know, you don't need groups. I mean, belong to social groups and socialize and all that. You know, one of the biggest joys is to human connection and interaction. But be careful with that. You know, you don't want to go and give up yourself. You don't want to go and sacrifice yourself, you know, for the group. And
learn from history a little bit. We don't want a repeat of the Third Reich.
No, we don't. No. And when we know what happened with that, well, it's, you know, what goes around comes around. So, you know. But again, if you see something wrong, speak out. If you think something is wrong, speak out. Take the moral high ground. We all have a responsibility to speak out and make our community a better place, our town a better place, our country a better place. And but it takes, you know, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. We just have to be vigilant and not worn down like they're trying to wear us down now with all the chaos and all the unpredictability and all the just stupid carnival stuff, the carnival tricks that are happening with this White House and with this narcissist Donald Trump. So, you know, my only suggestion to your listeners is to vote this guy out. He doesn't deserve your vote. He deserves nothing. So he's just a, you know, so that's
making money off of scammy crap like cryptocurrencies and things that are so obvious in your face, con artistry. How does he even have one supporter left, I wonder?
And I want to say this too. If any of your listeners don't like my politics, don't buy my books. I don't care. I'm speaking from the heart, and this is my beliefs. I've already been warned that people won't buy my books because I'm, you know, too much of a progressive liberal. Well, that's fine. I mean, I'm not changing anything, and I'm a progressive liberal paranormal author. So, you know, there it is.
Yeah, you know, there. What you said, that's touching to me, because a lot of times it just takes one person to say something and stand up to a bully or a dictator or just the wrong way of thinking. And after that one person does it, another person is going to, it's like that movie Spartacus where they all stand up and say, I'm Spartacus. Next thing you know, what are you going to do if everybody's claiming to be Spartacus?
Or like in Network where what's his name goes, I'm not going to take it anymore. You know, he's screaming out the thing.
Hey, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You got to stand up for what's right. Stand up.
Well,
to
listen,
peer
Daniel, I appreciate the, interview, the podcast interview, and I hope I didn't get too political or too radical, but I don't know. I mean, you know, I just speak what's on my mind, and, you know.
Well, this is a program where you could say whatever you want to. I don't even mind cuss words or anything like that.
No.
I don't want to talk about things that are going to get my channel taken down, obviously. Yeah, besides that, I'm all about the freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Diversity and people being unique and not only who they are, but their viewpoints.
Yeah. And listen, I appreciate and respect you for saying that and for your, what I think is a progressive liberal intellectual attitude. So don't change. That's a wonderful thing. I'll tell you what, I miss Seattle. I had a lot of friends there, and you know, being in Seattle and Bremerton were the good old days. And so, anyway, but you're fortunate to live there. And you know, a bunch of my friends are in Washington State. You know, Mojo, he has his own podcast, Mojo the Mad. He does some graphics design for me. And Kristen Amanda, she's from Washington State as well. And Kristen wrote the foreword in my book, The Scream of the Haunted House. So she's just she's a wonderful person. And so,
all right. Anyway. Shout out to my fellow Washingtonians.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, stay away from that smoke and enjoy the rest of the weekend. And you know.
Yeah. Stay in touch. We will schedule another interview corresponding with your releases.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, I really appreciate it. And then again, if you read the book, please put a review on, okay?
Absolutely. Well, Maxim, I had a great time. I definitely want to do a part two, maybe a part three. And definitely thank you for your unique perspective and for you know, speaking out on things and delivering a great interview. And please enjoy the rest of your day and stay inspired. I will talk to you next time, my friend.
Daniel, thank you so much. Okay, take care. Namaste.
Namaste. All right. Great interview right there with our buddy, Maxim Furyk. Check out his books on Amazon. And remember to leave a review. He makes a very good point with that. Leave a review and let everybody know what you think. I don't have a whole lot to talk about. Just great interview. You know, these wildfires are pretty disturbing. You know, we talked about them a little bit earlier. I'm actually hesitant to go outside because you know, that stuff gets all up in your sinuses and gets in your lungs and actually affects you. And to think this is all because of one asshole, that he's angry at society, he's got his insecurities and demons. I guess he actually killed his father, and he wants to go around starting fires just to hurt people for no apparent reason. Some people need to get lives. Some people need to take a good hard look at themselves. And some people probably just shouldn't even exist. If you're the type of person that wants to kill thousands and thousands of people for no reason, I would probably be happier if you were not a part of the planet or the flat earth or whatever it is. All those animals. Luckily, nature has a way of bouncing back from things like this. Fires from lightning strikes and things like that are somewhat natural. Nature has a way of filling back in and creating little prairies and things like that for deer to graze. So rest assured, the forest will bounce back, but that does not mean we don't need to take a much better look at things and take much better care of things. You know, that's something that is hard for a lot of us to imagine. Everything's so narcissistic nowadays with the social media and the, everybody's hooked on these video games and this terrible pop music. And if you're not doing that, you're probably a sports junkie or something like that. But it really, we need to take more effort in helping other people. It's not easy because it doesn't necessarily make you feel good. It's not a dopamine hit to help somebody. It can be, but for the most part, it's not like doing things for yourself and stroking your own ego, which makes you feel, physiologically very good. There's a different type of good that you can feel that's a spiritual good. And I think that helping the environment is also a big part of that, because we're not going to be able to keep it going if we lose the salmon and things like that. Also this never-ending Iran war and the excuses and the idea that, we were talking about Trump. He told us he was going to make us all rich. His exact words, he's going to make everyone very, very rich. And now we see prices sky high, eggs, waffles, fast food. You can't get a Big Mac anymore unless you pay like $15 for a disgusting burger and some salty fries and a big giant soda that's going to make you diabetic in no time. I would know. As you guys know, I took over a year off from doing the show, and a lot of it was the fast food, the gas station food. You might notice that I've lost a tiny bit of weight. My weight tends to fluctuate. I'm like a balloon. I'll be real skinny one day, and then I'll be bloated out, and I can't do it anymore. I got to try to stay skinny. It's not about my appearance. It's about my heart and my health and doing what I need to do to not be one of these guys that dies at 48 or 64. I want to live to be 118. So I have to get very, very in shape. And that might mean riding the spin bike behind me, or it might mean doing a little fasting here and there, or drinking lots of green tea instead of coffee and energy drinks. Notice you haven't seen me sucking on pepperoni sticks. You haven't seen me sucking on spicy Cheetos. You haven't seen me bragging about the junk food that I would eat every podcast, because a podcast is a party and a party is a celebration. So you got to have all the good food, right? Nope, can't do that anymore. Now I got to sit here and drink my tea. And ironically, the fasting thing isn't so bad. And I'm not saying you can just starve yourself to get in shape. You got to eat good when you do eat, and you need exercise too. Don't think you can do one of these things. It takes work. You can't just eat right. You can't just fast. You can't just exercise. You got to do it all, baby. You got to do it all. And it's not easy because we're surrounded by lots of quick snacks. Why go home and cook something when you can just grab some fast food? Or, hey, I'm watching my favorite show. What sounds good with that? Oh, a bag of chips. No, you're probably just going to have to sit there. But the nice thing is, when you don't act like a couch potato and you don't eat all the time, you tend to spend your time doing more productive things. The salt, that's what gets people. And it's very hard to avoid salt. You have salty breakfast foods, salty snack foods. A lot of your dinner food is going to have salt in it. If it's lunch meat that comes in a package, it's going to be, you know, just loaded with salt. And that stuff is a killer. You will not make it past... When you're young, you can absorb anything. But, you know, like people tell you, when you hit 40, it's going to hit back. 40 is going to hit back. It's going to punch you in your ignorant face. But the reason why I talk about this, I want you guys to know I never gave up or felt discouraged about this show or podcasting. I know people probably think that because they saw me trickle down and then just take like over a year off. But that's not it. It's because I worked my ass off. I was run down and very unhealthy. I'm a victim of being too damn successful, too damn alpha, that it's actually, I'm so alpha that it's killing me with my fat butt. that's an alpha ass. If it's nice and big and spongy, that means you're eating a lot of good food and you have money to pay for the food. No, seriously, don't eat like that. You ever heard of that book, This or That? That's literally what you have to do. Instead of eating this freaking chunky value meal, upsold meal from McDonald's with the fries and the soda, I'll just have the burger and some water. There you go. You just took unhealthy and made it somewhat acceptable. Besides that, there is possibility we'll be on break next week. Just need to go do something. I won't share it right now. Maybe I'll tell you after. But we are back, and we will be doing a show once a week consistently. Usually it's going to be around this time on a Saturday. I like to say 7 p.m. on Saturday. So if you like the show, if you like the live shows, and I'll see about bringing some of you guys on, you know, like we used to ask questions and things like that if you're interested. And don't forget to go to endofdaysradio.com. You know, you got to be careful because there's a lot of hackers in Russia and China, and they'll do just about anything to screw your world up and get inside of your devices and things like that. And you really have to be careful. So that's another big warning I want to just throw out there today. Make sure your security on all your stuff is elite. Do not give out your information. Don't do a video podcast with your face on. No, I'm just kidding. But you know, be careful what you put out there. Be careful because everything is technology. Everything is smart devices nowadays. And you know, all your information is in there. Keep an eye on your money and your money on your mind. Also, well, you know what? I think I'm going to call that a day. I do have a few other things I was going to talk about, but we went about an hour and 40 minutes, and that's good. Like I said, the long show just isn't really a possibility anymore. As much as I love doing it, you know, getting together with a bunch of people and partying into the night, that wasn't really a show. That was more of a party. And as much as I like doing that, partying all the time, it will mess you up. When I was younger, I would always party. Like, all my friends were all about drinking and smoking weed. And I think your life tends to go in one of two directions after that. Either you grow up, you either get a career going, you start a family, and you get away from that stuff, or you get more into it and become like a fentanyl addict or something like that, or a meth addict, or a cocaine lover. People tell me you can do cocaine and not be a drug addict. I don't know about that. But I think that I think that if you manage to avoid your life going that way, that's a good thing. Luckily, I seem to have done that myself. I used to be really into like mushrooms and LSD and things like that, but that shit's too crazy for me. Life is crazy enough with all this paranormal stuff going on, UFOs in the sky, remote viewing, witchcraft, Sasquatch, families of Sasquatch trying to make you one of their own. I don't see why I need to make things even crazier by seeing the walls melt or finding out that I've been Jesus this whole time. Oh, it turns out this whole time I was Jesus. I was born into this life to spread the word. No, seriously. Boy, that guest was refreshing, wasn't he? It's kind of nice hearing a little bit of the skepticism here and there, and also that he's a little bit more on the left. So many people in the truth community are very right-wing, and if you say anything bad about Trump, they get their panties all in a knot. And I do say panties because chances are that if you're MAGA, you probably wear satin panties or silk. I just lost half my audience. No, really. I'm sure that it's funny because they say don't talk about Trump or you'll lose half your audience. Yet Trump he never loses half his audience, does he? No matter who he fondles or makes fun of or starts wars with, he can say whatever he wants. And when he does it, it's cool. But how dare I criticize our alpha overlord, Lord Orangehead, with his farting and his diaper and the fact that he's literally in love with his daughter, which I understand. I think Ivanka looks great with that swan-like neck of hers. She's very beautiful, but she's a con artist just like her father. What's with making all that money off of that island or whatever is going on there? People think that's cool because, you know, that's the system they support. Even though I have no money, I'm still going to do whatever I can to support the people that do have money and who tell me what to do with my life. Right. But I probably shouldn't talk about politics. After all, I'm just a weirdo sitting in a little room with a spin bike and an alien head with a hat on. Anyways, thanks everybody. It's been great. Let me peek at some of these comments real quick. From Jafar. He's been on the show before. Wars are to make the real rulers rich. Richer. Damn straight. Wars are business. And business is profit. And chances are, some way, somehow, on either side of the war, it's going to create some kind of opportunity for you, whether that's weapons or rebuilding or there's a million different ways. But yeah, it also is great for population control too, and getting rid of a lot of the men, because men are the ones that tend to create revolutions and things like that. From Jeff B321, program through trauma-based mind control, they dress up as aliens and rape them. Yeah, that seems to happen. Imagine getting violated by some weirdo, government weirdo in a rubber suit. And he's probably getting paid $40,000 a year to traumatize you with his disgusting rubber fingers. They probably just made him at some Chinese factory. So where are all these rubber hands headed? Oh, they're going underground to the MKUltra programming. These fingers are going to go up somebody's butthole. All right. Thank you, everybody. I'm Daniel, liberal at heart. No, I'm just kidding. I'm on the fence always. And I thank you so much. Please donate to the show. Go to endofdaysradio.com. Click that donate button. And it's a wrap. I'm signing out from that shimmering Emerald City. I will see everybody next time. Might be next week, but most likely the week after next. Love you guys. Once again, you are The Wind Beneath My Wings. Hit that outro music.
We follow the sun.